Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. In her new book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science, today's guest, science historian Dr. Audra Wolfe, examines the role that scientists played in American cultural diplomacy after World War II and uncovers the close relationship between the U.S. government and private scientific groups like the National Academy of Sciences. She also looks at today's war on science, and she writes that scientists like economists, lawyers, and politicians have to make choices in the ongoing struggle for freedom and equality. The political choices that they make today in their lives and their work will affect our global society for years to come. So what was the relationship between the government and scientists during the Cold War, and how do scientists engage with structures of power today? To explore these questions, we are joined by Dr. Audra Wolfe, a Philadelphia-based writer, editor, and historian. She is the author of Competing with the Soviets, Science, Technology, and the State in Cold War America. Her new book is Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. Her articles have appeared in many publications, including The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and Slate. And if you are in the Bay Area, Dr. Audra Wolfe's will be speaking today at 4 o'clock at UC Berkeley, 470 Stevens Hall. And Dr. Audra Wolfe joins us in studio. Hi, Audra. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, this is a fascinating book looking at the relationship and the choices that scientists make during the Cold War, and we're still living with the consequences of a lot of their work, including the atomic bomb. Why did you decide to write about this, about the relationship between science and politics during the Cold War?
You know, I didn't know that I was writing a book about science and politics in the Cold War. I thought I was writing a biography of a geneticist named Bentley Glass. And Glass was a civil libertarian. He was the kind of scientist who many historians of science said had really been marginalized during the Cold War because of their work on behalf of scientific freedom. And as I researched the project, I began to realize that that's not what was happening with Bentley Glass and some of these other scientists at all. While he might have had some trouble on the domestic front with the FBI and McCarthyism, on the international front, Bentley Glass had very close relationships with the State Department and other government agencies promoting the values of American science abroad. And I began to realize that this was a much broader story about how ideas about scientific freedom, really the relationship between science and freedom and democracy, were part of the global Cold War and ideas about the virtues of American life.
Well, I'm guessing that a lot of people have never heard of Bentley Glass. So can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Sure. Bentley Glass was a geneticist who was based at Johns Hopkins University. He was famous almost as much for his role as an administrator as he was for his science. But the science that he did tended to be in the area of radiogenetics, so the effects of radiation on genetic inheritance. And obviously, this was a huge issue in the 1950s after the usage of the atomic bomb. And he became very outspoken about the dangers of fallout. This was a period when atomic bombs were routinely tested in the atmosphere. Both the United States and the Soviet Union were doing this. The UK was doing this. So there was a lot of radiation around the globe during this period of time. And Glass was one of the scientists who was trying to bring the public's attention to that. And as part of that, he became very involved with some international scientist groups that were working on disarmament, like the Pugwash movement. But he was also involved in a personal level, kind of in his personal life, as a civil libertarian. He famously refused to sign a loyalty oath in 1960 in Maryland. He was on the Maryland ACLU. He was the head of the Maryland ACLU for 10 years. He was even on the Baltimore County School Board during the years right after Brown versus Board of Education. So he was an interesting guy who had a lot of extracurricular interest on top of his scientific work. And he was an interesting figure to get a sense of the various ways that these scientists were involved in American life.
So when you were doing research on Glass, that kind of opened something new for you and you decided to take on this book. Can you talk about the research involved and just, I guess, what your goal was ultimately?
Right. I wanted to understand the role of science in American foreign relations during this time period. That is a vast goal, and I have a vast research kind of archival stash about that, but obviously I couldn't write about. I couldn't do all of that in one single book. So the book really became about ideas about science in the global Cold War. But I spent a lot of time at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. I spent a lot of time in the papers of individual scientists, and I spent a lot of time in the archives of places like the Hoover Institution down at Stanford, which has a lot of sort of intelligence-related collections. It's not officially an intelligence collection, but for a variety of reasons, they have materials there that are often related to the more conservative elements of American foreign policy during the Cold War period. So I would go to an archive with my digital camera. This is how historians usually do their archival research these days. And I would take, maybe 1,000 pictures a day, and then I would come home. I would do this for a few weeks at a time, come home with tens of thousands of photographs. And then I would try to code them and understand what was in them and seek patterns and try to make sense from the story. Doing the research that way allowed me to see patterns that otherwise would have been invisible and fairly quiet. This book is built on a lot of subtle relationships and sort of unseen links, some of which were previously classified, some of which weren't. But unless you see them all together, it's very difficult to see the patterns emerge.
Wow. You also thank in your acknowledgments the community of Cold War historians and historians of science and the online community of hashtag Twitter historians. When you spoke with Cold War and science historians, what really stood out for you? When you told them you were writing about this very big topic, what did they say were the most important points to really explore?
Well, one of the things that was really interesting in writing this was finding a common language with each other, because this particular story depends a lot on what are called pass-through organizations and also cover organizations. These Cold War campaigns were carried out by covert and overt and private organizations. And the thing about a cover organization, when it's successful, is that you can talk about it. It's in the open literature. If you're an organization that received funding, you could list it in your annual grants. So when I would talk with my colleagues, one of the things that we would just have to establish was what was a cover. There were organizations with really innocuous names, like the Edsel Fund, that were created solely to basically launder the CIA's money. Now, these projects that the CIA was funding, they weren't necessarily things that look like cloak and dagger work, right? So the State Department and USAID and a CIA-backed organization might all be funding the same kinds of work, but their sources might or might not be visible. So when I had conversations with colleagues, they would want to know things like, was I surprised to find the CIA involved? And the answer to that would be no. But then we would have a conversation about what that involvement means. Was this a project about trying to understand individual responsibility? Was this a project about trying to understand structural factors? Was this a project about just understanding how American power worked in the world more generally? I hope that the book that I've written is about that last issue, because this is a story that's much more than about any single individual's participation, but about sort of a coordinated system of during a period when so many scientists were operating with government funds, that this is a much bigger story about how the United States was using its power in the world during the Cold War.
Well, that section was so interesting in the book when you look at the relationship between the CIA and so many private organizations, organizations that many of us are familiar with but maybe don't really know what they do. The American Anthropological Association, American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Chemical Safety, the American Geophysical Union. I mean, the list is so incredibly long. The American Psychological Association, the American Sociological Association. Can you name a couple that really stood out for you? And was a lot of what you learned new for you?
Sure. Well, the first thing I want to do is just clarify that those kinds of organizations that you're mentioning now would often receive very small amounts of money from an organization that was a CIA organization. So, for instance, the American Anthropological Association was not receiving money directly from the CIA. It was receiving small grants from an organization called the Asia Foundation that still exists here in the Bay Area. It's a non-governmental organization that does international development work. And today it gets most of its money from acknowledged government sources, mostly from the State Department. But from its founding in 1954 until 1967, the Asia Foundation was basically run. This was a CIA project that was designed to do development work in Asia, basically without reporting to Congress. In some ways, its early incarnation was more like a CIA-backed USAID. So the Asia Foundation would work with any number of private organizations. You've just listed a few. But what they would do in those cases would be support the international membership of scientists in some of the countries that they wanted to target. So they would say, hey, American Anthropological Association, we've heard that you would love to have closer relationships with scientists who were working on countries that surrounded the People's Republic of China, but that scientists in these countries have a hard time paying for their membership, maybe because of currency, exchange issues. We would be happy to fund those memberships. And so this is a very kind of subtle way of building relationships between elites and kind of creating groups of Western leading scientists who were also kind of leading scientists in their own countries that might be more American leaning. One can argue, I think, about how nefarious of an activity this is. If in some ways, this is one of the kindest and gentlest ways that I can think of to build American power in the world. But it is still premised on the notion that that is the real goal of, say, international scientific cooperation, right? That it's not necessarily really about doing international scientific cooperation, but about building certain kinds of relationships that would advance American interest in the long term. Again, in a very subtle way, but this was the ultimate goal of some of these relationships.
And can you elaborate on the power structures? I mean, how did the CIA get involved in this, and how did these relationships really work?
Right. Well, the earliest version, so let's go back to 1947, sort of when the Cold War was really heating up. The United States and the Soviet Union found themselves engaged in this ramped up process of psychological warfare. And the idea was that if this was really an ideological war, that you needed people, and if the United States was promoting the cause of freedom, that you wanted other countries to choose freedom voluntarily. If they were choosing freedom through force, it wouldn't be meaningful. So the goal was to convince both technocrats, elites, regular citizens that they would prefer the Western system, capitalism, to communism. And so science became a part of that. But from the CIA's perspective, working at an arm's length provided lots of benefits. It was originally started, for plausible deniability, basically. It was also cheaper. It provided certain kinds of expertise, for instance, language abilities that the CIA, which was a new institution, didn't necessarily have. But again, this was also kind of an ideological idea. If the message that you're trying to convey is that in American life, professionals, in this case scientists, that they're not controlled by the government, it's really hard to convey that message in acknowledged diplomatic efforts, right? Because that's showing the government's hand. So these arm-length relationships became standard, particularly in science, where the message was that the government doesn't interfere with science.
In your acknowledgments, you also thank reporters at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Ramparts, who in 1966 and 67 convinced their editors that some secrets had been kept long enough. Their series of stories on the CIA's vast network of private partners changed how the public understood the work of the U.S. government. And you open the chapter that's so interesting, Chapter 8, with this. On February 12, 1967, the White House received a deeply unwelcome welcome tip. Ramparts, a radical West Coast magazine, planned to expose the CIA's long-term involvement with the National Student Association, a respected mainstream organization of collegiate leaders. Rumors of secret CIA funding channels had been circulating for years, but the timing and content of the Ramparts article threatened to blow the lid off the CIA's entire network of private organizations. Talk more about the importance of that kind of reporting in the late 60s and what it did.
The amazing thing about the story was that it stayed secret for as long as it did. This structure of relying on private partners meant that thousands of people had access to secret information that they didn't necessarily want. The stories eventually broke because some of these secrets were being trusted entrusted with college students. Up until the period of Vietnam, many Americans were willing to keep those secrets in the broader, in terms of the broader work of anti-communism. But as public attitudes about communism and the justness of the United States war on communism, as these concerns were getting stronger, people were beginning to have more concerns about that. For years, journalists had been hearing rumors. In some cases, they would report bits of it. In 1965, some of these fake foundations ended up in the newspapers because of a hearing about tax law that was in Congress, in which someone realized that some of these foundations that were tax exempt weren't quite what they seemed. So journalists knew these. A lot of them knew these secrets, but they were willing to keep. They were willing to not print them in the broader national interest. And by 1966 and by 1967, that consensus was changing. And these journalists had decided that the time had come to talk about this, in part because the stories were going to break anyway. Whether it was going to be young people talking about it or whether the covers were going to be blown by some other parties. So the spring of 1967 became almost a ratings war in newspapers between Ramparts and the New York Times and the Washington Post. There were a series of, almost weekly, almost daily front page stories about this group was, this labor group received money, this arts group received money, this group of intellectuals received money, on and on and on and on. And when you read those, some of the conspiracy theories, you can understand why some of those conspiracy theories came about, because it looked like the CIA was involved in everything. That's not quite the case. That's not really what was happening here. But a certain amount of paranoia, it's understandable when you read those newspaper reports and when you see kind of the depths of the links.
What was the fallout from these reports? I when I read this section, I was thinking a lot about surveillance and the New York Times decision to withhold stories, and the reporter James Risen, who left the New York Times and now works at The Intercept, wrote all about what happened at the New York Times. So what was the fallout?
Right. Well, I should preface what I'm about to say by saying that I don't have a clearance today, and so I'm having I've never had a clearance, and so I'm having to assume that what I have learned is an adequate a reasonably accurate representation of what's being of what was happening. But the short version of this was that in 1967, senior foreign policy officials decided that the costs of having these private partnerships was too great to bear. And so in 1967, President Johnson decided that the CIA was no longer going to be funding these kinds of private groups that appeared to be private independent groups that were really something else. So the CIA really got out of the business of cultural diplomacy in 1967, which isn't to say that the entire government got out of cultural diplomacy, but it became more the province of overt agencies, whether that might be the State Department or the U.S. Information Agency. And obviously, these groups had been doing that work all along. But the decision at that point was that the United States should only be conducting its cultural diplomacy through overt groups.
Today, we are speaking with science historian Audra Wolf about her new book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. And if you have any questions for Audra about what she uncovered, she writes extensively about the role scientists played in American cultural diplomacy after World War II and uncovers the close relationship between the U.S. government and private scientific groups. And then she also explores what we're dealing with today, today's war on science. And she argues that scientists have to make a choice in the ongoing struggle for freedom and equality. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. If you're a scientist, we'd love to hear from you. How do you think history should judge scientists like Oppenheimer, the head of the Los Alamos Laboratory, who's credited with being the father of the atomic bomb for his role in the Manhattan Project, and then he later protested against U.S. plans to build the hydrogen bomb? What are your thoughts on that? And then also, any question for Audra just about what she found in her research about the Cold War. Audra, when the media started focusing on this in 1967, do you know, how did other countries respond to this, especially affected countries?
The response was surprisingly muted. The State Department was absolutely worried that there would be a crisis, and they sent out a series of circulars to, you know, International Post about how they should respond. But surprisingly, there were very few repercussions. One place where there were was in India. So India decided that no U.S. foundation could support work there for a few years. Because, you know, one of the consequences of these blown covers was that many people felt that it was now impossible to distinguish between legitimate, international groups that were genuinely independent and those that had been a cover. And the Indian government decided that they also could not make that decision, and so they basically stopped working with American foundations for a few years. In some other places, some of the literary journals that had been funded by some of these fronts were banned. There was one called Haiwar, which was an Arabic language kind of arts and letters sort of literary magazine that was banned from certain parts of the Arab world after these covers were blown. But for scientists, the response was surprisingly muted. The one exception was in the American Anthropological Association, where many anthropologists who had been doing the work of ethnography realized how closely their work resembled intelligence gathering, and many of them became deeply uncomfortable with doing this work or working with the government in any way. But I would say, on the whole, the international response was surprisingly muted under the circumstances. I think one has to put this in the context of the rising international opposition to the United States' involvement in the Vietnam War. I think by 1967, these revelations weren't particularly surprising to a lot of people. They were sort of in keeping with what many nations were already beginning to think about the United States government. So it wasn't a dramatic change in that way.
Did scientists from other countries, like the United States and other countries, did they travel to other countries to take part in conferences to talk about all of this?
Yes. Well, not necessarily to talk about the revelations, but I would say the phenomenon of international conferences is, in an odd way, absolutely related to these ideas about a Cold War that involves ideas about scientific freedom. The United States wanted to project itself as the opposite of how science was being conducted in the Soviet Union. So the United States was really pushing the idea that science in the Soviet Union was intensely nationalistic, intensely devoted to just national goals, and that it was closed, that you couldn't do science in the Soviet Union, you know, if you didn't have some kind of, communist affiliation. And so the United States really wanted to project this image of the opposite of that. And so the United States absolutely encouraged many of its scientists to participate in international events, even sponsored some international events, as a way to, tell the rest of the world, look, the United States values open science. For the record, that's a lovely idea. Not all of these ideas are terrible ideas, but they're also not naturally occurring. And so to talk about some of these ideas as kind of Cold War propaganda or, ideas that had to be constructed and maintained, these were choices about how science should be. And this is the idea that science should be international.
Today we are speaking with Dr. Audra Wolf, a science historian, about her new book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. She examines the role scientists played in American cultural diplomacy after World War II and uncovers the close relationship between the U.S. government and private scientific groups. She also explores today's war on science and argues that scientists have choices to make in the ongoing struggle for freedom and equality. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about voter suppression. Nearly 16 million voters were removed from the rolls across the country between 2014 and 2016. This year alone, more than 700,000 voters have been purged in Georgia ahead of a very contentious gubernatorial race. And then I'm sure you've heard about the Supreme Court declining to rule on a North Dakota voter ID law that directly affects Native Americans. So we're going to talk about how voter suppression is shaping the 2018 midterms. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. You can also sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by science historian Dr. Audra Wolfe. She's out with a new book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. If you have any questions or comments for Audra, we'd love to hear from you. If you're a scientist, or if you're just concerned about what we are seeing with science and the war on science, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Audra, you have mentioned scientific freedom a couple times during the show. How do you define that?
Scientific freedom is really the idea that scientists should be left to their own devices to make their own decisions about what they should work on, no matter the source of funds, and that scientists should really be the only people involved in really governing the scientific community. There are certain aspects of scientific freedom that are very laudable and very desirable, especially the notion of empiricism, which is that scientific research should be based on facts as opposed to received authority. That is ideally how science should work. But some of the challenges with scientific freedom are the idea that no matter how large the project is, even if it's funded by public sources, that the public should have no say in that whatsoever, and that kind of only scientific matters should be governing what scientists pursue. So if one wanted to question that idea, you know, we can go back to the founding of the National Science Foundation in 1950. The original proposals for the National Science Foundation, right after World War II, really there were two separate models. One was a much more public service-oriented version of the National Science Foundation, in which the National Science Foundation would be responsible for funding work across the country in various, you know, states and congressional districts, and in which the National Science Foundation would work on certain priorities that were related to national priorities. But at the time, at this moment of rising anti-communism, that felt like planning, and planning felt like communism. So the alternative was to do a version of the National Science Foundation that really embraced scientific freedom, that would be led by scientists, where all of the decisions would be made by scientists through peer review, and that scientists should choose the director. The eventual version of the National Science Foundation sort of combined some of those ideas. The director would be appointed by the president, but the National Science Foundation's funding decisions would be evaluated by scientists, and the goals would be set by science. There's a lot to be said for that, but it's also true that any country has certain pressing national needs. And when you say that scientists should not be at all responsible to national needs, that raises some questions about how is this a public good? How does this relate to the broader political economy?
Can you talk about how the U.S., after all of this was exposed, how did the U.S. change its use of soft power? I mean, specifically, you write about how the United States stepped up its own propaganda campaign after launching the Marshall Plan, and then the Soviet Union retaliated by launching its own operation. And so you had these international information programs like Voice of America, or, for example, or the CIA's funding of literary journals like Encounter. Can you talk more about soft power?
Right. So soft power is the idea that instead of using military might or even strong economic motivators to pressure other countries, that you can convince them, that you can sway their opinion, basically through persuasion. And there are different ways of doing that. There are what they call white propaganda, which is propaganda that is true, that has acknowledged sources. This is the kind of propaganda, some might call it information, that the U.S. Information Agency and the Voice of America broadcast. There's a variety of propaganda called gray propaganda, which is also, usually promoting true information, or maybe it might be propaganda of the deed, but perhaps its sources are obscured, not actively misled, but maybe it's a little difficult to figure that out. So during this time period, an example would be if the United States government wanted to encourage certain kinds of cultural production, say in Munich, and they wanted the mayor of Munich to get credit for that, maybe they would fund it and just kind of be quiet about it. And then there's black propaganda, which might involve active lies, it might involve misinformation, it might involve active confusion about the source of that information. Those were things that the United States did as well. This book is mostly about either gray, it's mostly about overt gray, or things that are true-ish, but the sources are obscured. So in some ways, this book is really about the carrot side of soft power. This is about attempting to persuade people to do what the United States wanted them to do, to see the appeals of the American way of life, and to come over to that side willingly. But soft power was absolutely always accompanied by harder power. In some places, that might be economics. In some places, that might be paramilitary operations. And by the mid-1960s, I think it became harder to pretend that those were completely separate tracks.
Earlier, we were talking about what happened after the media broke some of these stories. But you say that many of the scientists during the Cold War really didn't realize how their scientific freedom was put to political use. Did anything stand out for you when you were writing this book about how scientists responded after learning about all of this?
Yeah, there's a really striking example after those CIA revelations in 1967 that involves some physicists who were involved with the Pugwash movement, which is an international disarmament movement. You know, it's a little unclear how much money, if any, the Pugwash actually received from some of these covert funding streams. And that's actually one of the things about this book, is that some questions are not particularly answerable. But what's interesting in this situation is that the players involved say, yes, we think it's a possibility. We received $3,500 once from one of these organizations that was named in the New York Times, but we don't think that it matters because they didn't interfere with our work. They didn't interfere with our scientific freedom. They didn't tell us what to say. And in a way, this is they were so convinced that you could that objectivity could protect them from political involvement that they couldn't see the ways that they were participating in American foreign policy projects. And so I think that's really some of the danger of this language, that scientists can convince themselves that they're operating separate from state power, that they're operating separately from it because they're making their own decisions. But, they're not necessarily considering, the opportunities that they have to speak in public or the international conferences that only exist because the United States wanted to promote the idea of a certain flavor of scientific freedom. So it's very, very difficult to take scientists out of that position. And that's not necessarily a criticism of them per se. All of us exist in a particular political concept. The problem is that they were convincing themselves that scientists uniquely could transcend those political demands.
Where does the word Pugwash come from?
Pugwash was the name of a town in Nova Scotia. The person who funded Pugwash was a man named Cyrus Eaton, who was from a town in Nova Scotia called Pugwash. And so the initial Pugwash meeting was held in Pugwash, Nova Scotia, and the name stuck. It had another name, I think the Committee on Worldwide Scientific Affairs, but people generally call it Pugwash.
Well, I'm looking at pugwash.org, and yes. It says, Pugwash seeks a world free of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. Through our longstanding tradition of dialogue across divides that also earned us the Nobel Peace Prize in 1995, Pugwash aims to develop and support the use of scientific evidence-based policymaking, focusing on areas where nuclear and WMD risks are present. How strong is this group now? How active is this group today?
they're still around. Their high point was really during the Cold War, both in the early 1960s, in the lead up to the partial test ban agreements, and then again in the 1980s, their role in some of the disarmament negotiations. They are absolutely well-intentioned people who do good work. And they may not have been wrong in the idea that they could do this kind of work if they appeared to be a group of independent scientists. But what's really interesting about the I don't know as much about their work in the 1980s, but the period where I have studied in the late 1950s and early 1960s, what's interesting about that work was how the American participants in Pugwash were trying to position themselves as uniquely free from political considerations. And they contrasted their ability to do that with their Soviet colleagues. So the idea was that if they were negotiating on a technical point, that the Americans would be more trustworthy because they would be basing their opinions on scientific evidence, on technical ability, whereas the Soviet participants might be basically political hacks. So they were trying to project this idea that the Americans would be better negotiators because they weren't affiliated with the government. Technically, it is true, they were not affiliated with the government. But they were absolutely doing what's now known as back-channel negotiation, or sometimes called Track 2 diplomacy. The State Department was very interested in exploring this notion of Track 2 diplomacy, basically when private citizens are working alongside or on a separate track from formal diplomatic negotiations. So the American participants in Pugwash would have briefings at the State Department. At one particular meeting in Moscow, a Pugwash meeting in Moscow in 1960, some of the American participants were getting debriefed every night by the American American ambassador to the Soviet Union. So yes, they were nominally a group of independent kind of transnational scientists, but they were working very closely to make sure that the positions that they were negotiating were in keeping with what the United States wanted to see happen.
Hmm. Who were some of the scientists that challenged U.S. Cold War policies and its arms race with the Soviet Union?
If we want to look at real oppositional stances, one of the best known, for good reason, is Linus Pauling. And Pauling's role in the story is quite interesting because it highlights some of the differences between doing this kind of work in cooperation with state power or separately. Pauling was involved in the earliest days of the Pugwash movement, which started out really as a nuclear abolition movement, a movement to free the world of bombs. But as the test ban these negotiations between the United States and the Soviet Union continued, it became clear that the United States government would never go for that. So instead, they might be open to the idea of a test ban. And so a lot of the scientists involved with Pugwash, they got on board with the idea of a test ban. It was a smaller goal, but it was an achievable goal, and they thought there was something to be said for that. Linus Pauling, for his part, really stayed committed to this idea that we needed a world that did not have nuclear weapons. And he quickly became sidelined from the Pugwash movement because he seemed an outlier. He was making arguments based on moral and ethical claims as opposed to scientific claims. And it became very difficult to fit him into that kind of logic from where Pugwash gets its expertise, like the excerpt that you read from the website. If you're making a moral claim about nuclear weapons, that's very different than an evidence-based claim for nuclear weapons. So Pauling is an interesting character to see what it looks like if you really do want to, you know, make a political claim. Pauling was more than comfortable to say nuclear weapons are wrong.
And in your section, Science for Diplomacy, you write that by the summer of 1962, Pauling, a U.S. chemist, had already won one Nobel Prize for his work on chemical bonds and was well on his way to picking up a rare second Nobel for his work on behalf of nuclear disarmament. From May 1957 to July 1958, Pauling collected the signatures of more than 11,000 scientists from around the world in support of a nuclear test ban. That's pretty impressive. Obviously, that was before we had online signature gathering. And then you write, over the next 5 years, he wrote books, gave hundreds of lectures, and engaged in verbal fisticuffs with physicist Edward Teller, director of Livermore National Lab, the loudest advocate for ever bigger bombs. And Pauling also faced repeated investigations by the U.S. Senate for his alleged connections to communist groups.
Yes. And the fight between Pauling and Teller is actually really telling because it was a moment for some of these other scientists, like Bentley Glass, who I mentioned at the beginning of our interview, to kind of distinguish what they were doing. So to someone like Bentley Glass, who was involved in Pugwash, who absolutely embraced these ideas that science could operate free from politics, Pauling's kind of screeds against the bomb seemed too extreme. They seemed intemperate. They seemed not objective. And even though Glass would say that he was more sympathetic to Pauling's position, he didn't like how Pauling was doing it. And so he criticized both Pauling and Teller for being emotional in their responses to how they talked about the bomb, for bringing in their political attitudes about it. Now, at the same time, what's interesting about this, you mentioned that Pauling had assembled these petitions of 11,000 scientists. Pauling was more than willing to make a moral argument, but he did think that scientists had a better standing to make that argument than other members of the public. Scientists weren't the only ones who were waging a fight against the bomb, and there were many thousands, millions perhaps, of people across the world, many of whom weren't scientists at all, who also were engaged in campaigns about the bomb, who took the slightly more radical position that you don't need scientific knowledge if you're making a moral claim. You don't need scientific credentials to make that claim.
And you write that for a brief moment in 1946, it appeared that scientists' advice might compel the U.S. to participate in some kind of international uranium authority with control of atomic energy placed squarely in civilian hands. But by late 1946, the rise of anti-communist sentiment and revelations of atomic espionage in the U.S. diminished scientists' influence over atomic policy.
Right. 1946 is a very interesting moment in American history for these ideas about whether it might be science or kind of international relations in general. The United States and Soviet Union were allies during World War II. They had a complicated relationship, but they were on the same side against fascism. And for a couple of years, there were people talking about things like world governments, you know, what the UN was going to look like. There was an interesting kind of global ferment about the ideas of how you would prevent a global catastrophe like World War II in the future. And people were experimenting with all sorts of ideas, including kind of a more optimistic idea about global control of, atomic energy that ultimately didn't come to pass. It was sidelined by rising anti-communism in 1947.
And how did scientists become the target of the House Un-American Activities Committee? And many were accused of being communists.
Well, from the position of 1947, if you were trying to understand what happened in World War II from a military perspective, it seemed like science had won World War II for the Allies. Whether that was about the atomic bomb or radar or about the proximity fuse, it seemed that scientists were the thing that had made the difference. And so the United States wanted to make sure that it was going to continue to have that advantage in the future. In the meantime, they had been very concerned about the amount of Soviet espionage during World War II. And there was Soviet espionage, including in the Manhattan Project. So the Soviet Union had more information than the United States wanted it to have about the American nuclear program. So in Congress in particular, several senators and congressmen were extremely concerned that scientists were going to be the weak link, that scientists were going to give all the secrets away. What's complicated for understanding and telling the story in 2018 is that it was both a witch hunt, but some of the witches were real, if you want to use that language of witch hunts. There was an extremely fevered search for communists in the government, but we know in retrospect that there was a fairly elaborate Soviet espionage effort that was fairly successful at getting secrets from the Manhattan Project, which doesn't mean that the vast majority of American scientists were untrustworthy in 1947. The story is a little more complicated than many historians were telling it even 15 years ago, when it may have seemed that just a lot of, that it was a lot of McCarthyism, unjustified attacks. It has become clear that, there were some real concerns about intelligence. Unfortunately, these concerns were not handled in a kind of thoughtful way, but really a blanket smear on American scientists.
And moving to today, you have said that one of the strangest moments in writing the book was when the Trump administration's transition team asked the Department of Energy for a list of scientists who had participated in certain international meetings related to climate change, and there was a widespread fears of some kind of purge.
Right. The reason that that felt so strange to me was that it felt like something straight out of the Soviet playbook from 1948. So it felt like a Cold War episode, but not from the American side. The Soviet Union absolutely did limit its scientist freedoms during this time period, particularly in genetics. If you've heard the term Lysenkoism batted around, that term comes from a Ukrainian agronomist with the name of Trofim Lysenko, who had some fairly unorthodox ideas about inheritance. But for this story, what matters is that in 1948, the Communist Party endorsed his theories. And so scientists who had other views of genetics were sidelined. They lost their job. Institutions that had genetics in their name were often shuttered. And you really couldn't do something that looked like Western genetics in the Soviet Union during that time period. So when the when Trump's transition team asked for a list of scientists who had participated in international climate meetings from the DOE, from the Department of Energy, that looked like Lysenkoism in action. And it was very unsettling. The Department of Energy ultimately did not produce that list of names. But it was a fairly shocking thing to see, a fairly shocking departure from the ways that the federal government usually handles its scientific workers.
And I also can't help but think about the purge of scientists at the EPA or people who've left willingly. The last time you were on the show, we talked about this. And a couple months ago, the Daily Beast reported that John Kelly signed off on a purge of Scott Pruitt loyalists from the EPA. We were talking about just how awful it is that people who really dedicate their lives to public service and do really good, important work have left the EPA.
Yes, there's been just a shocking exodus of people. And then, of course, there are also new people who aren't seeking careers in public service because of the ways that this work has been politicized in other ways. So it's a challenging and tricky time for scientists to figure out how to speak their values in a way that is also speaking truth to power.
What's it been like for you? I mean, to write this book and then here we are with the Trump administration doing so much damage to so many environmental policies that many said, you know, clearly did not even go far enough, and yet he's getting rid of so many of them. And, you know, one of the main points you make is that scientists really need to take a stand. They need to make choices when it comes to the struggle for freedom and equality.
Absolutely. I was so shocked, and I think many of us were shocked, with the administration's comments on transgender people a couple of weeks ago. But one of the things that really jumped out in the administration's policy was the idea that they would make decisions based on objective scientific findings. And what we're seeing in the past 6 months or so in particular is really ramping up of this language of objectivity, really retrograde ideas, but housed in this language of objectivity. When we were talking about the EPA, it might have been for this idea of the transparency rule that you could only use the best data, the science that's based on sort of an absolutely pristine data to make your scientific decisions. In this case, it's using supposedly objective scientific data about genitalia to make decisions about the future of transgender people. So, you know, conservatives have figured out that some of this language is appealing and that you can use this language to enforce a status quo or actually to kind of clamp down on the status quo. And scientists need to understand that that's happening. Falling back on the language of scientific objectivity isn't going to protect them, and it's not going to protect anyone else. So scientists need to step up and kind of understand that they have a role to play in that.
And for people who don't know the specifics, because so much is happening so quickly, the New York Times reported that the administration is considering narrowly defining gender as a biological immutable condition determined by genitalia at birth, the most drastic move yet in a government-wide effort to roll back recognition and protections of trans people under federal civil rights laws. A series of decisions by the Obama administration loosened the legal concept of gender in federal programs, including in education and in healthcare. Do you know, have many scientists spoken out against this?
They're starting to. And in fact, I believe there was a statement. Unfortunately, I can't tell you which organization it was, but I know that some group of scientists have basically said, this is not an accurate representation of science. But what's interesting about that is that's absolutely true. It's not a valid representation of science. But you could also answer that in another way and say, if we're talking about people's self-determination and people's self-identity, that objective scientific data may not actually be the point here, and that you can defend the rights of transgender people even if the science said said this, and science doesn't say that. I want to be super clear about that. But even if that weren't the case, you could do the right thing and defend the rights of transgender people without basing it in science.
And in our final moments, Audra, can you point to other examples of scientists really stepping up? I mean, we saw it during the March for Science, a worldwide march. We've had on so many scientists on the show who say that basically we need to be louder and clearer. I mean, the Union of Concerned Scientists we're having on regularly, and it seems like they're really taking up their argument a couple notches. Can you point to any groups or people who are really standing up and, you know, elevating their voices like they haven't before?
Well, I think a fairly dramatic change was the recent IPCC report, in which the IPCC absolutely embraced, you know, really drove home the idea this is an alarming moment for climate change. You know, many of their past reports have been couched in kind of technocratic language, that this is a problem that can be, you know, that we need to address by doing X, Y, and Z. This most recent report just sort of went for it and said, you know, really went for some emotional appeals in some ways. And I think in general, we're seeing scientists understanding that they're going to need to be more directly. They're going to need to speak more directly about their goals. And the consequences that just speaking in a neutral, objective language isn't going to cut it in 2018.
And money plays such a crucial role in all of this. I mean, we have multi-billion dollar multinational companies that have spread lies about climate change for decades. They get op-eds in newspapers. Their people go on cable shows, although not as much in these so-called debates. Just quickly, how does that differ from the lies and the propaganda that were spread during the Cold War era?
Well, you know, I think what we're seeing now that's changing, during the Cold War, we would see people offering false ideas, but often trying to hide who was behind them. That happened for a while in the past, but one of the things that's different now is that many opponents of climate change work will acknowledge who's supporting them, and they will just say, we don't believe you should fight this. We are backed by, you know, Company X, and we think that this is wrong.
Dr. Audra Wolfe is a science historian and author of the new book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. If you're in the Bay Area, Dr. Audra Wolfe will be speaking today at 4 o'clock at UC Berkeley, 470 Stevens Hall. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Audra, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about voter suppression. Nearly 16 million voters were removed from the rolls across the country between 2014 and 2016. This year, more than 700,000 voters were purged in Georgia ahead of a contentious gubernatorial race, and the Supreme Court declined to rule on a North Dakota voter ID law, which directly affects Native Americans. So we will talk about how voter suppression is shaping the 2018 midterms. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio, email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
This is Joseph Pache of City Visions. Vote much? The right to vote is crucial to our democracy, yet across the country, purges of voter rolls, strict ID requirements, and cutbacks in early voting are increasing barriers to the ballot box. How might these restrictions on the right to vote impact the midterm elections? Join me for City Visions this evening at 7 here on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco.